Thank you, Steve. Hello, everyone. I'm Bill. Wendy, who's normally heard in this time, will not be heard today nor tomorrow, but will return from her vacation on Friday. In the meantime, Harry Tynowitz, who was here yesterday, who you've all grown up with and loved for years and years and years, for decades, is filling in. Hello, Harry.
What are the odds that somebody would make a typo twice on the schedule
scheduling
at the same week?
Yeah, it's very hard to predict sometimes. Here's just a little bit of behind the scenes. Prior to the show, we were all trying to figure out exactly how much of the Robert Mueller testimony we would carry here on regular WGN, as I like to call it. So here's what's going to happen. Steve will monitor it in the newsroom, and should something very important come up, I mean, not all the whole thing is very important, I get that, but something that needs to be heard right then and there will break in, but more than likely what you'll hear is us, and we'll get updates during the news, certainly. And if you want to hear the whole conversation there of what's going on at the hearing, just go to WGNradio.com, and we have a second stream set up for you, so you'll be able to hear it there.
Very cool.
Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, you know, we get to focus on the show, and then Steve, who's, like, you know, adept at this kind of situation,
right,
he's monitoring it. And Mueller hearings will not be going on tomorrow.
Right.
So Steve is just going to be watching old Westerns,
yes,
all day, and
right,
he'll monitor those.
Right. What's wrong with that, Shane?
you'll get a lot of that. A lot of questions about High Chaparral.
Yeah.
On tomorrow?
Sure. Questions like, was Chuck Connors really that bad of a hitter?
Yep.
Very
important question.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I have noticed about the hearing, I'll do just really briefly, and then we'll talk about other things.
Sure,
there's plenty
we will.
Of other things to talk about, is I'm not used to women being referred to as gentle ladies. But several times already, when they talk to one of the guys, they'll say something and, of course, refer to him as gentleman. But when it's a woman who's involved, they will refer to her as gentle lady, which I don't think I thought that was some sort of a body prep kit for a lady. I didn't know what that was until just now.
It's very weird to hear. I feel you. I'm on your side. Yeah, gentle, I think, is reserved for dudes and for bears.
Right. Exactly. Well said.
Uh-huh.
All right. Much to discuss with you today. Let's start out with this. Yesterday, I think we mentioned this during the show. It was picture day here at WGN,
uh-huh,
and this is where everybody who works here full-time, I don't want to leave you out, Harry, you're doing fill-in work, so they did not have you do a picture,
right,
which
right,
I would have been offended by, but you seem to be handling it.
No, that's fine. So the guy from the courtroom came and did like a sketch of me, a rendering.
That's even better.
Mm-hmm.
More accurate. All right, so they did this thing where, and I remember this distinctly from grade school and high school, whenever you'd have your picture taken, they would take it straight on, and then they would do this thing where they would move your head. They would go, tilt your chin up just a little more to the left, a little more, so that your head is at an angle that normally you would never, ever have your head at.
Why?
But I still don't know why. Because when I went home, my wife said, how did the pictures go? And I said, it was just like in school where they have you. Did you ever see, like in a school yearbook, almost everybody looks okay, but like one out of every 20 people, their head's at a strange angle, and you go,
oh, yeah.
What happened to that guy's head?
Oh, yeah, I know specifically who you're talking about.
Was it you?
No, it wasn't me. It wasn't
right,
me. But when you got home, was Terry's first thing that she said to you, hey, Bill, you can untilt your head now?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like that weird head. Yeah.
Did you go through that same thing, Steve?
Absolutely. Then you, well, put your right arm in. Okay, now take your left arm.
I felt like I was playing Twister.
Exactly.
I was like, okay, my left knee over my right. Move the okay.
I couldn't contort my body that way. I'm
no,
fairly agile. I could not make my body go. And she the woman taking the gentle
she was
lady.
Awesome, by the way.
She finally just said, well, let's do something else. Which I'm like, yeah, I could have told you that 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, do a handstand backwards.
Well, they were trying to find our best sides, I think.
Oh, that could have turned straight around from them.
they only had
enjoy
one
it
day.
Right. Right. But Mary, why the thing with the head? What is the head tilt? What is there a reason for that? It never looks natural ever.
Well, I think it does sometimes. When you you can't take a picture head on with just seeing, you know, your nose.
But you know what?
I mean, you have to kind of tilt your head.
In the world of photographs being taken of
uh-huh
me, I like in-action shots. I like when somebody doesn't tell me that they're posing me for a picture, when they just snap a picture and then there it is.
Well, didn't they do some candid shots
no
of you? Oh,
I think they
really
were so upset that I couldn't tilt my body that way that they just went, just get him in and out of here quickly.
Did you wear your hat?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Good.
He wore Frank Thomas's
hat. So no
hat.
One's going to recognize you.
Right. Right.
You know, my brother Danny, who never married or had kids, he comes over to the house, and when my kids were little, he'd go, "Oh, that's a great picture. Okay, you guys stay there."
Oh,
stay
really?
There. He's three, she's eight. They're not going to stay there. Take the picture
right.
now.
Please, take
it's
the picture
it's like
now.
Ordinary people. Take the damn picture, mother.
I wanted to see the proofs right then and there because I never come out looking the way I want to look. And with all the head tilting, I knew this wasn't going to be a good thing. So I wanted to ask, but I'm just like, I did the part I was supposed to do. I showed up. Uh-huh. I was fairly well-dressed, fairly, by my own standards, well-dressed.
She would have showed them to you.
Do you think so?
She showed them to me. Well, I just saw like a couple. Yeah.
You know who was really good at this? David Miranda from The Newsroom.
Oh, he's a TV star.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. He got all dolled up.
He got all dolled up, and I watched it. I know this sounds creepy, but I wanted to see how it should be done. So
you watched him get dressed?
No, I didn't watch him get dressed,
okay,
Terry.
Okay, good.
No. I watched his photo shoot, and I just watched how natural it worked, and I think, Mary, you're onto it. He's used to being on TV, so he knew...
Yeah.
He knew the angles.
Yeah, he does video work all the time.
They didn't even tell him to do his head tilt.
He was giving me makeup advice.
Is that right?
Yeah. I asked him what shirt to wear. Yeah, you got to go to David.
He works the Clinique counter at Nordstrom's when he's not here in the newsroom.
May I spray you?
With what?
May I spray you?
With Paraquat. No, you may not spray me with Paraquat. No.
I never really used them, but as a gift, someone gave me, like, for my 25th birthday, Twister bed sheets.
They make Twister bed sheets?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Same never used them?
Well, I used them. But
maybe when's your anniversary? All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break. We've got plenty to discuss with you. Stick around. It's Bill Leff and Harry Tynowitz in for Wendy Snyder on WGN. That beautiful voice you just heard is that of Harry Tynowitz. He's filling in for Wendy. Wendy will be back on Friday. Just a few moments ago, I was explaining that yesterday here at WGN was picture day. I went in. I struggled with it. They had me moving my head in all kinds of weird ways, holding my face the way my face doesn't like to be held.
Only you could struggle with...
But the one guy here at WGN whose photo shoot I watched and I admired was David Miranda's. If only David Miranda from the newsroom were here to tell us the whole story. Wait a minute. He's right over there. Hi, David.
I have a question.
Sure, please.
I didn't have an opportunity to do that yesterday. Who did your hair?
They flew in a team.
Oh, I imagine.
From John Amico. They flew in a whole team of hairstylists.
I heard you talking with Mary Vanderbilt and Bertrand, Steve Bertrand, about the photo shoot. The thing is that it's the dancing days. In the dancing days, you learn how to pose. You learn how... There's some pictures for dancing that you think that are live. No, they're posed. They're obviously posed.
So whenever someone takes your picture, do you always do jazz hands?
No, I do not.
But yesterday, David, like they were telling me, a little more to the left, now more to the right, now up, no, too much. I don't even think they were telling you things. You were just instinctively doing them.
I don't know. I guess it's second nature now. Since I do some TV work as well,
yeah.
I guess I know my angles. So my chin, what's this called?
The Adam's apple, the jawline?
The jawline could look a lot better,
yeah.
I guess. And there's a lot of tricks too. Like when you dress for TV, there's certain clothes, like the stripes shouldn't be horizontal. They have to be vertical if you wear any patterns.
I've heard that, but that doesn't apply to you. That just applies like to heavier people,
right?
No, but for example, TV increments weight, so you like look like 10 pounds heavier.
In my case, TV makes me like 20 points dumber on the SATs.
David, our old producer Kevin figured out a way in which whenever Wendy and I will take pictures with the guests, when Kevin would take our picture, he would put the camera way up high so that the angle that we were shot at was up to down, you know, to make us look.
Better because you won't have a double chin. Sometimes even the lights in the studio will, because they're on top, they would make a shadow on your chin.
But now Jasmine, who is a foot and a half shorter than Kevin was, has tried to do that, and there's no way because she just doesn't have the height element. So she has to go up to the 19th floor and take pictures of us from 19 so that we look right.
Is your producer still on the roof?
He's up at Tribune Tower.
Yeah,
he can't get off the roof. He better hurry. That building's going to be demolished. He better hurry up. Well, you did a great job yesterday. It was fun to watch your photo shoot.
Thank you.
You knew what you were doing.
Thanks a lot. You know, it was very early in the morning. That was my only hassle because I normally, when I take headshots, I like to have music. I like to have like music blasting.
What's the best music to play to inspire you during headshots?
Any type of music. Normally, Peter like reggaeton.
Yeah.
Reggaeton, like or
Dan
merengue.
Fogelberg.
Fogelberg's good, yeah.
Dan Fogelbohr.
Elvis.
The talking headshots. There's so many.
I mean, talking headshots.
There's a bunch you could take.
The talking headshots.
Well, from now on, whenever there's picture day, I need your help. I need your assistance.
Yes.
Because you know what you're doing.
More than happy to do so.
And if I ever call you from a police station, it's because they need two poses.
That's a mugshot.
Yeah.
To the right, to the left.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what your headshot should be, Harry. One straight on, one to the side.
Oh, it's all over. It's
just
all
make
over.
Make sure you don't call me when they have you take all your clothes off.
Oh, that's crazy.
No. That would not be.
No. Nobody wins there.
David, thank you.
All right,
a job well done. I'm anxious to see your proofs, whatever that means. I just know that's something people say in the photo business.
Uh-huh. He's a dancer. Like I wonder, like when they were taking his pictures, was it like a chorus line? And you know, Michael Douglas is yelling, "Stop popping your hips."
I'll let you in on a secret no one's supposed to know. Every single person in the newsroom has dance in their background. There's not a single person working at the WGN newsroom hasn't done.
There is some single person.
Oh, just other than Steve. Steve is the only person who is not. But everybody else.
See, I would think a guy that like you know travels all over the world would have a bunch of different dances he could pull out of his back pocket.
No, not necessarily that way. There was a death in show business a few days ago, and we did not get to it yesterday. And I know that it's obscure, but I want to mention this person because I didn't have anything to do with their death. Normally, when somebody in show business dies, we get a bunch of texts saying, "Hey, you killed this person," or "This person is dead. I hope you're happy." I'm never happy when anybody dies under any circumstance, but I will admit that there is a weird correlation between me mentioning the names of obscure celebrities and those celebrities sadly checking out within a day or two after my mentions.
That is the definition of a tease.
David Hedison.
David Hedison
has passed away.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Bill, just one question.
Yes.
Who's David
Hedison? I knew that would come up. David Hedison is known for two things primarily. Now, he had a long, long, incredible career, but the two things people should know or would know David Hedison are Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Yes. It's available as we speak on MeTV.
Yes. It was David Hedison and the great
Richard Basehart.
Yeah.
Who went on to do L.A. Law.
Yeah. No. He was not in L.A. Law. Richard Dysart was in L.A. Law.
Oh, no, I think you're thinking of the guy that was in The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz.
No. That's not
Richard Dreyfuss?
That's Richard Dreyfuss, right.
Okay.
All right, so David Hedison, best known for his work on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, mm-hmm. which was a great sci-fi Irwin Allen series from the 1960s. His other work, and this is classic, he was the original Fly in the movie The Fly.
Really?
That was David Hedison.
That's an awesome part.
That movie still to this day has one of those scenes that even though I have seen 10,000 horror movies in my lifetime, the scene at the end, I guess I have to say spoiler alert, even though this movie was made in the early 1950s.
Yeah, 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah. By now, I'm hoping everybody has seen The Fly who wants to see The Fly, but if you've not seen it, please just turn your radio down or off for just a half a minute. So I can tell you what this scene is. As you know, in the movie The Fly is the hybrid of a doctor and a fly who got into the machine while they were conducting an experiment.
Right, he's trying to get the good qualities. He's wondering if it's possible he could pick up some of the fly's qualities.
Yes, yes. So at the end of the movie, there's a scene where the fly part of the fly, not the human part, but the fly part gets caught in a net. And you see the fly in the spider web saying, "Help me." And it's got David Hedison's head, but a fly body, and he's in this spider web. It's so creepy that for years and years and years, that was a nightmare of mine. It was just that one scene. The whole movie's great, but that one scene is the standout scene.
You know what creeps me out is the Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis remake of The Fly.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah, that was pretty good, and that's where they met. And
then got married.
Yes.
Was he Seth Brundle in that movie? Is that his character's name?
Have you ever considered a hobby, Bill?
No.
And he didn't, I said it wrong, but the fly got in the machine. He didn't want the fly in the machine.
Right.
Yes.
Right, right, right.
But I don't know if his name was Seth Brundle or
not. The creepiest part of the remake of The Fly was that he kept a small, like a cabinet, with parts of his body that had fallen off.
Yeah.
And if you look closely in that scene, if you stop motion it and just watch it, if you have it on DVD, some of the body parts are really upsetting that have fallen off of him and he's kept on a shelf.
It's gross, and now I have to go watch it. You know what horror movie scene I always remember? I saw the movie once as a kid, but the incredible Shrinking Man.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
The scene where he has shrunk so low that now a spider... It's a spider, and it's like a monster spider.
Right.
Because even though it's the same size, he's shrunk so small.
Right.
And he has to get like a pin.
It's very scary.
Oh, yeah.
That gives credence to my theory that there are so many things that we see on a daily basis that if they were 10 times their normal size, it would be the end of us.
I do like that theory.
There's so many things I've seen in my life that I say, I'm so glad that caterpillar is only 3 inches, because if it were 10 times that size and I saw it crawling across my floor, I'd scream so loud.
Right, I'm that way with Texas toast.
Right. If Texas toast were 10 times the size, we'd all be in trouble. Rich is on the line. Rich, David Hedison is no longer among us. Very sad news, huh?
Right, but you forgot one other thing that he's unique for in his acting career. In all the James Bond movies, it seems like in every movie, the role of Felix Leiter was a different character. But David Hedison is the only person that played Felix Leiter twice. He played it in the Roger Moore, To Live and Let Die, and then again with Timothy Dalton in License to Kill.
I think he's the first actor to play him twice, because Jeffrey Wright has played him more than once since, correct?
Yeah.
Not that I know of. And the only other recurring characters I think of is Maude Adams, but she played two different characters.
Oh, yes, yes.
And again... the man in You Only Live Twice, the man that was Henderson, his contact in Japan, came back in Diamonds Are Forever, but played Blofeld. So you do have reoccurring actors, but in different roles. But David Hedison's the only one I could think of that came back and played the same role.
Rich, that's brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. I had no idea. That's excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, too many reruns.
No, I know. Believe me, I suffer the same illness. Thank you.
You know, if I find a James Bond movie on TV, it's so hard to switch off it. Even if it's like on Her Majesty's Secret Service with George Lazenby.
Now, I have to say, George Lazenby over the years has been maligned for playing James Bond just the one time.
He was really good.
Can I say, when we went to Switzerland last month, we went to that mountaintop where they shot the film? Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
I don't think I've ever seen the movie, but...
But still.
The greatest snow-capped mountain is The Spy Who Loved Me, when Roger Moore, you know, says goodbye to Barbara Bach, Mrs. Yes. Ringo Starr.
Yes.
And he goes skiing, and there's like six assassins on skis waiting for him.
Right.
And I will not spoil that, because if you haven't seen that, you know, shame on you, Mark Kerman. But if you haven't seen that, you need to see it, because it's the greatest setup, greatest opening scene into a Bond song.
Yeah, probably right. You're probably right. And remind me on George Lazenby, when he made that movie, when he was James Bond.
Yes.
He had never starred in a movie before, right?
I don't believe so.
That was his first starring role?
Right. It was in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I think Sean Connery had done the first three?
Maybe more? Yeah.
They were churning him out a lot.
Yeah.
He breaks character. He talks to the audience.
Yeah, he does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
How un-Bondy.
Yeah, Bond would never break character.
We have a full show ahead. Stick around for that. Thanks, Steve. It's Bill F. It's Harry Tynowitz. You might think that physical fitness and comedy wouldn't go hand in hand. They wouldn't go together. You would be wrong. Bob Vanney is here right now. He's got a show, Tell All Fitness Training Comedy Show, that'll be at the Laugh Factory on Thursday, August the 8th. Hi. Nice to see you, Bob.
Well, first and foremost, thanks for having me. Well, I know I could die now, because I just asked Walter Jacobson where the bathroom's at. So, you know, I made it. This is the
That's the pinnacle. It doesn't get better than that.
Right, exactly. But, thanks for having me, Bill. Appreciate
All right.
It.
So, like I said, this is an unlikely pairing, because having done stand-up for years, and Harry was a stand-up for years, sometimes the stand-up comics aren't the most physically fit people on the planet.
Correct.
Sometimes.
Correct.
But you've managed to not only maintain yourself, but you're in peak physical condition. What's going going on? How are you doing this?
Because of my shtick, 30 years of in-home fitness training, and I have to stay in shape because I'm doing a one-man show about 30 years of in-home training, and the stories are just hilarious. They're true, crazy stories. With my client's consent, they let me tell these stories.
You use the real names or not the real names?
No, you use nicknames.
Okay.
So like,
that's
better. Like Negotiating Ned. He's always trying to negotiate the workout.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, we're doing 20 push-ups, 20 sit-ups, 20 dips. He's like, no, think of something else. I'm not doing it.
Wait a minute. I grew up next to that guy.
He goes, let's do 9-6-3. I go, 9-6. Are we negotiating? You don't negotiate.
You can't negotiate training.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
I look over. He's lighting up. He's like, that's a good plan, but it sucks. I'm not doing it. I got a headache. Think of something else. You know? So there's that guy. And then, oh, my gosh, crazy Carl. He hates late. If you show up on time, you're late. One time I was 10 minutes late. I get in the basement. He's a Vietnam vet. He comes up behind me, puts his thumb under my thumb. He goes, you know, I can kill you 8 different ways with my thumb. I go, what are you doing? He's like, you're late. Well, there's a train. It stopped. He goes, dit. I don't want to know what happened out at sea. I just want to have ships come in. You know?
Wow.
It's crazy Carl. You know?
Dangerous.
Overly seductive Susan. I'm mad at you. Why? Because I had my lips done. You didn't even notice. Like, but it's 7 a.m. I don't even know my own lips look like. So, yeah, very seductive women.
Do your clients know that you're writing a book, and do they try to get into it by doing something crazy?
They're climbing over each other. Oh, tell this story. Tell this story. Yeah, they're all, they love it. Yeah, like there's Yo-Yo Diet Daryl. He's always like, you know, we all know this guy. You know, like, he's like, I got the condiment diet. I lost 10 pounds in 4 days. It's always 10 pounds in four days. I have condiments, relish, mustard, ketchup.
Oh.
Yeah, right. First, I got the runs, but I lost 10 pounds.
Well, that's so good news.
Gave it all back. The peanut M, yeah, the peanut M&M diet. One peanut M&M every 15 minutes. You could bank them for the rest of the day. A whole bowl of peanut. I lost 10 pounds in 4 days. Yeah. And the shot glass diet. You can eat whatever you want, but it's got to be in the shot glass. He's trying to make these own gimmicks up. He loses it, but he gains it back. He doesn't listen.
With shot glass diet, can you take as many trips as you want back?
I think you can.
Yeah.
I think you can.
Yeah.
All right. Have you ever had a period in your life where you've been out of shape? You've been in good shape forever, right?
I have since football, since I was 12.
Yeah.
But I tried an experiment. I tried to see how much weight I can gain and how much I can gain it back, because I want to see. They say once you're in shape before, you can get it back quick. So that's it. Yeah. Once you're in shape before, it's called body memory. You'll get it back quick. So I gave myself the test. I was hating it, but I gained 20-some pounds, and I lost it all. And,
you wanted to do that.
I wanted
you
to.
You set out to do that.
Kind of like the McDonald's guy, remember? The Big Macs. And,
Morgan Spurlock.
A whole month.
I was breathing heavy. I hated it. I felt like I couldn't even put my clothes on. It was just so uncomfortable, but I like being in this way. I'm so used to it. I mean, we're creatures of habit. Like, I'd rather have a chopped salad than a cheeseburger, you know, because it takes metabolism to speed up, you know, to lose weight. So
do you ever cheat on the diet yourself? Do you ever just have a birthday cake, just eat a whole cake or something?
6 days on, one day off.
Is that how you do it?
One day off, but my stomach can't take it because I'm so used to, you know, eating clean.
Right.
And all of a sudden, okay, let's have a pizza. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah,
so, yeah, it's,
it messes with you.
Yeah, it messes with you. So,
can you whip anyone into shape? Have you ever met anyone that you said to yourself, "I can't. This is somebody I cannot."
30 years, over 500 clients. Yes, give me anyone I could.
Really?
Yeah, I had a man who was 550 pounds. He lost. We had to get down 200 pounds because he was too heavy for the surgery. So we got him down to 200. He got him down to 3-something, and he got the surgery, but he had to lose 200 pounds first.
Yeah.
Because he didn't qualify. So
they wouldn't do the surgery on him unless he lost 200 pounds.
Exactly.
Wow. How long did it take to get him down to 200?
Yeah, a solid year.
And that's the lap band surgery, the two stomachs?
It was the lap band surgery. Yes, yes.
Yeah, the only, I know two people that had that surgery that didn't work on. One of them is here in Chicago. The other one is Charlie Weiss, the former Patriots defensive coordinator and Notre Dame coach.
Yeah,
he sued. He sued the hospital and he sued the surgeons individually because he had the surgery, and like 2 months later, he's got all his weight back.
Yeah.
I think you can go to court and say, Charlie, it's not the surgery.
Right.
Yeah.
Bob, what about this? As we get older, it gets harder and harder to maintain a certain physical physique or to lose weight. What do you tell people that are getting up into their 40s or into their 50s and beyond, where it's harder and harder?
First and foremost, weight's impact. You need impact. because you lose testosterone. When you're 30 years old, you start losing 2% a year of testosterone. So you have to hit those weights. Even those testosterone shots are great. Yeah, we get up there. We have to work out. It's like brushing your teeth. You have to work out now. It's got to be almost like 6 days, 7 days a week. And
that often, yeah, huh?
You have to hit the weights first, because for every pound of muscle you have, you burn up to 50 calories per pound. Every pound of fat you have, you burn 2 calories per pound. So you got to have impact. So, and you can't bulk up from weights. I have negative Nancy. You're bulking me up. I'm bulk. Yes, you are. You know, No, it's your poor eating that's bulking you up. So yeah, weights first and foremost. And the aerobic is minimal. You know, the heart's a dumb muscle. If you're doing curls, your heart's getting in shape. You don't have to run 10 miles. And they're saying that's bad for your knees. It's, you know, so yeah.
Is it bad for your knees to run that often? It is.
Wrong. Yeah. I mean, there's ways you can do it right, but nobody knows how to run right. I mean, people run like this, and they're on the concrete, wrong shoes. I mean, it's so perfected today.
Sure.
But if you know,
as a stand-up, you have this unique, I've never seen before, ability to incorporate your physical training and the regimens you give for people, and it works into it shows up on stage as great material. Exactly. Does it work in reverse? Like when you've got a patient, when you've got someone who you're training, call him a client.
All right.
If you've got a client and like he's not able to go as fast as you want him to go or lift as much as you want to lift or do whatever, do you break out the humor? Is it always fun?
Yeah, you have to make it fun because you got to be accountable. Like, oh, I don't want to work out today. Oh, I get to see Bob. He'll make me laugh. So they want to see you. Right, because the average trainer lasts around 12 weeks. I have got clients for 30 years.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, his brother.
You're doing
years.
Something, right?
Yeah. He said, you got me for six months, young man. And all of a sudden, 28 years later. You know. So yeah, if they like you, you're just set. But yeah, they have to believe in you. You have to look the part. You know, you don't want to walk in, okay, ready to go, snap out a cigarette.
So no. Don't smoke while you're training,
you're
saying.
Stage.
Okay,
good. Right.
You That's
you
solid
know,
advice.
Yeah, you want to, you know, they say practice what you preach and all that. So exactly.
Bob, you mentioned working out 6 days a week is in your best interest, but I've had trainers tell me you don't want to work muscles 2 days in a row. You got to give the muscles time to react to what you've just done. Is that true
or
not?
Exactly. Yeah. You want to give it rest. So I hit each body part twice a week. Remember, it's 70% eating, too. I mean, your muscles 80% water, so you got to get 1/3 in ounces of your body weight in water. I mean, you need proteins, lean meats, salads, that pizza. You know, if there's a 500 calorie burger and a 500 calorie chopped salad, everyone's like, oh, I'll just have the burger. It's 500 calories. No, it takes nutrition to burn fat, speed up your metabolism. So go for that salad. So that's the thing.
The breakdown time is different.
Yeah. The 100 calorie snack wells, that's all garbage. You want to, So real nutrition. So, but I'm educating people on stage and making them laugh at the same time with the stories, which is so unique about this.
You've cornered the market on this. I don't know anyone else is doing this.
This is the first time I got a book coming out, and it's, it's just it's pretty incredible. I'm having a blast with it. These are true copyrighted stories, and I talk about I invented an ab device that was on QVC, and it broke on stage. Oh. 80 million homes. That's a sequel, but yeah.
That's not good.
I was on Oprah. I had this mobile gym.
Hold that thought, because I want to ask you about your contact with Oprah. Bob Vanney's here. BobbyVShow.com is the website to visit, and he'll be performing at the Laugh Factory. Coming up soon, the show is in August 8th, Thursday, August 8th, and 8. Doors open at 7, but the show will start at 8. We'll pick this up in just a little bit. It's Bill and Harry in for Wendy on WGN. Spill F, it's Harry Tyner with Terry's filling in for Wendy. She'll be back on Friday. Bob Vanney's here, certified fitness trainer and comedian. His show, Tell All Fitness Training Comedy Show, will be at the Laugh Factory on Thursday, August 8th. Go to laughfactory.com. Your ticket information is there. It's harder for women to maintain a weight, isn't it, than it is for guys? It's not fair, it's true, isn't it?
It's very true. It's very true. It's just,
Why is that?
Well, they have more body fat.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. That's the bottom line. I mean, it goes back to the more muscle, the more fat you're going to burn. We're trying to get our bodies into a fat-burning machine. That's the goal. So, but some of these women at the clubs, though, great shape.
They're doing it good?
They know what to do. Yeah, a lot of these trainers. But, I just want to tell one more quick story. You know, a lot of, just because you're a certified trainer doesn't make you a certified, you know, physician, because mm-hmm. they're going to ask you medical questions. Right. And this guy pulls his pants down uh-huh. and his shorts, everything. And he goes, "Hey, Bob, what is this, like a wart or a cyst on my..." "Well, I'm not a doctor. Pull your pants up. Hey, take it easy. Take it easy. Just take a look at this. It's pussing over." Now he starts chasing me around. Uh-huh. I know we're in a radio, but he starts... Remember the potato sack race? He starts chasing me. "Come on. No, come here. I'm paying you. Get over here. Take a look at this." He starts chasing me around the room. So there's just stories after stories like that.
But you get a nice fruit basket on your birthday, so everybody everybody wins.
Exactly, right?
I'm just glad we could hear the phrase "pussing over" to
you. Yeah, the pussing. What is this? What is this, you know?
So there's obviously a psychological part of this, because, right. you know, if you're overweight, out of shape, you've fought the battle, you've done every diet, Atkins diet, Rice diet, right. you know, the Stokely diet. So the cerebral part where you encourage them, like, I tend to be really good during the day, but at night, I'm the last one awake, and I'm just up, and I'm watching TV, or I'm on the computer, so that's when I get in trouble. How do I stop myself from
good
doing
question.
That?
Which is my next thing.
I was due for a
I have
question.
My clients keep a log of everything they're doing. You think about having a steak, you write it down, your fruit, your vegetables, all your activity, rake in the air, golf. So I took a look at one of my clients' logs. He put down activity, Saturday morning, 9 a.m., sex with wife. Hmm. 9:01 nap. 9:40 So, but the bottom line is, you have to, you have to keep a log. Keeps you accountable, because once you derail, you're like, forget it. But you have to, a journal. It's almost like a journal. And have a calendar in your room. I used to do Kid Fit, and these kids were not listening. They're jumping on everything. So I created this 90-day board game called Healthy Habits for Kids. And when there was prizes, there's Vanny Bucks, and they loved it. Like, paying attention, they reached their goal, they did the push-ups. So, that's another
But don't you think, Bob, that that's the key to it, is getting people acclimated at a very young age to getting some kind of a regular workout.
Right? Exactly.
That's a big important part
of it. Well, they say, it's expensive, this dance. It's not true at all. It's very easy. It's just, it takes, you have to prep your food. Like, I have my clients prep on Sunday, you're going to prep again on Wednesday. Prep your food, because you're hungry, you're going to grab whatever you can see. I'm starving. We're creatures of habit. You're going to grab bread when you get home. But you have to be educated on why this works, why this, and in this day and age, I mean, still 1 in 3 kids are overweight, 1 in 6 are obese. I mean, it's getting, it's still bad. I mean, just, you know, a lot of underserved kids are just going for the McDonald's, the Taco Bell. But it's...
You say fast food in extreme moderation is okay? Like, if you do it every once in a while, that's fine. But doing it once or twice or three times a week, then you got a problem, huh?
Exactly, right. It's cheap, but I mean, McDonald's said, hey, you know, we have the salads, we got the yogurt. Don't blame us. Right. You know, we got everything, you know, so it's not on us. So, and they're right.
Everything in moderation, especially moderation.
Right. Boy, Harry, that's profound.
I like that.
That was beautiful. So my cousin...
Tearing up.
Not to go Gabe Kaplan on you. Right. But did I ever tell you, Bill, about my cousin Helen?
No, Gabe. What was he like?
Cousin Helen kept her scale in front of the refrigerator.
Nice.
Really extreme.
Wow. One of my clients, you could buy this online, a pound of fat. A pound of fat looks like this, like a floating brain. 1 pound of fat, he puts that on his kitchen table. Yeah. So remember Oprah? She wheeled
in a wagon.
Yeah, a wagon, 25 pounds.
She walked around with the wagon.
25 pounds of fat looks like this. Yeah, you don't... It'll just... gross shit. Like, why would you want to eat that? You know?
Yeah. So, speaking of Oprah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
You've had some contact with Oprah.
They called me, and I was on her show. It was incredible. I created these mobile homes, and I gutted them out, and I made them to mobile gyms. I started training people, the Ditkas, the local celebrities, in these mobile homes, and they called me and said, hey, you want to be my, it's called Pampering Your Life, you want to be on the show? I was on the show. I trained the audience, and that movie Tin Cup. Remember that movie?
Yes.
So Rene Russo, the whole cat, Kevin Costner, Don John. They're waiting for me to get done, and I was done because she does 2 shows a day, and so I was looking for the bathroom. Again, who I run into, Rene Russo. Hey, you're that mobile gym guy. I go, now, are we seeing other people? Are we exclusive? Or
wow.
And she, you're a doll. I went to give her a hug. She's like, did the swim move.
That's how the stars are, so Bob. That's how the stars are.
She's adorable.
So, wow.
But that was the Oprah experience.
Were you intimidated by Oprah, or was that comfortable for you?
Well, it was like... So the gym comes to you, blah, blah, blah. And then she goes, we'll be right back after this message. And then she goes, I would do that. I'd go to the gym. What? Oprah, you just told millions of people. Like, let's go to the gym. You know? But it's amazing. She stands there, and then the 5 people attack her. Makeup, and she lifts her leg up. They put new shoes on her, scarves. It's amazing what you. Yeah, the Oprah show is smaller than yeah.
You get a mobile gym, and you get a mobile gym. And you get a mobile gym. Very generous, that Oprah. That's exciting. That's great. Good for you.
I was on my Ditka show. I thought that was, you know.
Oh, wow. Oprah,
yeah, Ditka
coach.
Show. Yeah, the coach. Love that guy. Trained him and his wife.
What's the longest you've ever gone without doing physical fitness? Have you ever been in a period where you just go, you know what? I'm going to take a month off and just see what happens. Have you ever done that or never?
It's taking like a bottle away from a baby. I get crabby. If I don't work out, I get a little crabby. Ask my girlfriend. I had to take 10 days off. I had hernia surgery, and it was killing me that I had to take that off. But I, like, you know, try to work out, do something. Anything, just to say, you know, I am so – when you're we're creatures of habit. Once you're programmed in, you want to keep going. Because I'm so used to being in this shape since football, since high school.
Yeah.
And it's hard. When you get out of shape, it puts me in a depressed mode.
I totally get that.
It's like, that's not who I am.
I have a friend who smoked cigarettes for 35 years, and we'll just call him Danny Mac.
All right.
And 35 years he smoked cigarettes, and he stopped for like a week, and he was telling everybody that smoked how bad cigarette smoking is.
Right.
And he, shortly after that, went back to cigarettes.
Oh, no.
So I lost a bunch of weight, but I would never tell somebody who's out of shape to lose weight, because I realize how thin the ice, no pun intended, how thin the ice is. So do you ever like turn to a friend or a friend of a friend and say, hey, you really got to get in shape?
Yeah, I do. I just stay up. Well, they come to me, but I'll tease them, though, because you don't want to really, upset them. But yeah, they would come to me and ask. But that cigarette story kind of hits home, because I had a client who says, I never met her yet. She said, meet me in the basement. I'm warming up on the treadmill. So I go downstairs. I'm like, what is that smell? I turn the corner. She's on the treadmill with a cigarette ashtray. How you doing, doll? Did you find a place okay?
Smoking while working out.
Working out. And
so Joan Rivers didn't die. She was just in a basement on a stairmaster.
Smoking while working out. Yeah, that was you can't smoke it. Look, baby steps, okay, doll? We just met. You have to pay someone else 90 a session to hand me weights. I'm like, fine, you know. But
we live in a time where smoothies are, for most people, a daily drink or some sort of power bar. Are those good for you or not good for you?
Great question, and I'm going to say no, because
they're
high in calories. Like, you want to eat your fruit. You don't want to drink your fruit, you know, because the fiber fills you up. I mean, those Jamba juices could be 600 calories.
Yeah, right.
I'm surprised. You know, calorie is a calorie is a calorie. But
even the ones, Bob, the one that I drink this thing called Blue Machine, and it says no added sugar on it. Do I still want to stay away from that?
By law, what's the calories? Blue Machine. I've heard of it. But
It's like, somewhere in the 200s for like a 12-ounce bottle.
Oh, yeah.
It's not horrible.
Right. I know guys doing shake meal. They do a shake meal. Yeah. So I think that's good. But there's these 600 babies that are just
that's too much.
What's the problem here?
Yeah, that adds up.
Yeah, but you're right. It's keep it two. Yeah, you're supposed to have six meals a day. Have six
meals a day.
That's easy. But 300 calories.
I can do that by 4 o'clock.
Yeah. What you don't want to do is do one big meal at the end of the day. Your metabolism slows down after 3 o'clock, so
get your bigger eating done early and let it taper off as the day goes on.
We had this nanny, and she's like, "You Americans, we don't have dinner. You have late dinners, 9 p.m.
Yep.
Like, yeah, we eat late. Like, no, we have no dinner. We just have a light snack at 3, 4. That's it. We're done. So
right?
They, you know, so breakfast, lunch. And then that's
what happens.
And then just you could have protein drinks, like whey protein drinks.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, what is your favorite treat, like to snack on, to cheat on?
That's a good question. It's movie popcorn. For some reason, movie popcorn is my favorite. I'm just I just never stopped.
You hold the butter off on that though.
Yeah, I hold the butter off, it's like the tub is gone. I don't care how full I am. I'm still gonna eat that.
Do it
right,
Bob. Great to see you. Go see Bob Vanni. He's performing now. This doesn't take place until August. It's August the 8th at the Laugh Factory. It's a show, tell all fitness training comedy show. And when is the book scheduled for release?
That's going to be in the fall of end of the year. Yeah,
you have a title for that already or not?
It's called Ripped. Yeah, it's called Ripped from Baby to Comedian. Yeah, Ripped Baby to Comedian. And there's a big, the picture is a picture of a mic on it.
I smell a movie deal.
Yeah.
The Rock is texting me. The Rock wants in on this, Bob. Go see Bob Vanni. Thanks, Bob. Great to see you. We'll take a quick break.
Thanks, Bob.
Absolutely.
Terrific.
A break, some news, more show. Bill and Harry in for Wendy on WGN. Steve, thanks very much. Bill Luff, it's Harry Tynowitz. Harry's filling in for Wendy, who, as I've mentioned, will be back on Friday. Every other Wednesday, Dr. John Duffy comes by. He's our show's psychologist, so he makes sense of things for us. John, nice to see you.
Good to see you. Here.
All right. I know there's things we need to cover with you today, but I want to bring something up. And I know you don't know this is coming. I'm springing this on you. There's this show on called Stranger Things.
Yes.
On Netflix. I don't know if you've ever, have you ever seen
the
show?
I have.
Okay. There's an actor on the show named Dacre Montgomery who plays Billy.
Okay.
Who on the show is a very, very bad kid.
Yes.
Okay. He is something of a heartthrob. He's a very popular media figure right now. So he just put something, he tweeted something the other day. Now, keep in mind, if you've never seen the show, all you need to know about him is he pretty much has everything going on. He's a good-looking guy. He's got great acting ability. Everybody loves him. He's playing this great character on television. The world belongs to him right
Absolutely.
Now. Absolutely. So I don't know if you saw his tweet the other day, but he posted a picture of himself from about 10 or 11 years ago where you wouldn't recognize him. He's an overweight kid with bad hair. He said on the picture, he wrote this: "When I was a kid, I was lost. I had a really tough time in school. I was a big kid who loved drama. I never got passing grades. I wasn't popular. I wasn't a gifted sports player. Girls were never interested in me. I suffered from anxiety from a young age. I was distracted and I wasn't focused." He then goes on to talk about the fact that he just stuck with it. He didn't give up on himself.
Right.
He said, "I've got a dream. I'm going to pursue that dream." He goes into detail about all the people who said to him, "You're never going to make it in this business. Find something else." And now he's at the top of the world.
Yeah.
What does this teach us?
So I love this use of social media. And every once in a while, you come across somebody who is really well-known. Ed Sheeran did this recently, too, where kind of he showed what he looked like, what he was like, his stammer and his stutter when he was younger, and that you can overcome some of these things. And I think they're speaking specifically to the kids I work with, these teenagers and tween-age kids who feel awkward, who feel like, man, it's the end of the world. I'm never going to look the way I want to look. I'm never going to feel the way I want to look. I'm never going to accomplish the things I want to accomplish. And I love when somebody brings the hope through a tweet like that and has something to back it up. They're not just saying, hey, believe in yourself. You know, a lot of people do that. A lot of people use social media, Instagram, Snapchat for that. But somebody who can actually back it up and say, look, I felt this way.
Yeah.
I felt like you felt. And look what happened in the wake of all that.
Yep.
It's a pretty great
Such
thing.
Such a brave thing to do for a guy who doesn't have to do this, to reach out to anybody who feels disenfranchised and say, do not give up on yourself.
Absolutely. And he does open himself up a little bit to some criticism,
sure.
Like, you know, and being made fun of for his young self. And that could still sting.
Yeah.
Even after all that.
You know, as the father of a teenager, two teenagers now, I keep forgetting, but as a father of two teenagers, they are both fascinated by politics.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter looked at two colleges very hard in D.C. because she said, Dad, I got to be there. That's where everything is happening.
Right.
And I've tried telling them it'll never be like this again. You know, that he got elected because people were sick of, you know, politicians, but he's the reason why, you know, people will probably never vote for anybody like this again. So they are both like, we'll sit down for dinner and they're talking politics and I want to talk about Avengers and stuff like that.
Right.
So, I mean, is this common? How do I? Cause I love it that they're educating themselves on other things.
Yeah,
but you know, is it like practical for them to be so into political talk?
Here's a really interesting thing about kids now is we talk about how insidious and awful social media can be, and it can be really overwhelming, can make kids feel really badly about themselves, but also they develop a point of view and a worldview at a very early age. And so they develop a sense of empathy as well. So a lot of very young kids care about politics. My wife and I happened to be among a bunch of 16, 17-year-old kids the other day. And they were sitting around talking about politics and culture and what are things going to be like if things don't change. They really are invested in the future. Sometimes I worry that they're over-invested at too young an age,
right.
You know what I mean? And
yeah,
that they're not prepared to, because they feel like they should be making some impact now. And I have a hard time convincing kids, oh, you have some time. You know, that's really our job right now. You have time to get there. But kids feel this urgency, like, you know, I think your generation kind of messed things up. We're in a hurry to get there and see if we can repair them.
Isn't that something, though, that a kid, a teenage kid who doesn't even have the right to vote yet, would take such a vested interest in what's going on. I commend them for that.
It's so potent that a couple of times this morning during these Mueller hearings, I'm hearing from kids who are distraught that there isn't truth-seeking going on in these hearings. They were hopeful that, oh, both sides are going to be looking for the truth now from this investigator. Mm-hmm. And now they're seeing this political posturing, and it leaves them a little bit hopeless. Like, you know, oh, this is how it's going to be. There really is no end in politics where we're looking for the truth and we're trying to do the right thing. Everyone just wants to keep their job. That's the feeling a lot of people, young people have about politics.
But don't you think, all right, so as we were growing up, during the Nixon years especially, politics took some very volatile, dangerous turns, and then things kind of ebbed quite a bit. I mean, politics is always a fiery discussion, don't get me wrong, but especially what we've seen in the last two or three or four years, it's never been this heated before. So what's your advice to kids who say, hey, everywhere I go, I'm bombarded with this anger that's coming out of politics. What do you do with that?
Well, first of all, it's this perfect storm, right? Because we have this incendiary situation in Washington right now.
Yeah.
In the wake of social media becoming this firestorm as well. So kids know everything that's going on. I was 8 years old during Watergate. I really didn't know what the deal was.
Yeah.
But an 8-year-old today has some feel for what's going on in Washington. So I usually try to tap that sense of empathy that they have, you know, and that, you know, like, hey, listen, there might be a little bit of something that you can do, even if it's making a post that describes how you feel. There's probably something you can do or something you can say that can make some impact there. It might not be a massive impact today, but over time, you can probably make some impact in what's going on in the world, in your little piece of the world. You don't have to affect Washington today.
We were always told, my parents used to tell my brother and I, the only thing that could ever make us, meaning my parents, stop loving you is if you lied, right?
Yeah.
So now we live in a situation where lying, what?
They told you that?
Yeah. They said, if you lie, we'll stop loving you. They might have been lying.
That explains a, explains a lot, Bill.
A little heavy-handed, huh? Right. Right. Okay, all right.
And they always told me that while we were playing poker. Isn't that crazy? So the question I have is, we now know that it's possible to lie and get away with it.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely.
So what does that do to the argument a parent might have about the importance of not lying?
So there is this huge parental opportunity here to talk to your kids about, like, okay, so there might not be immediate fallout from lying, but what do you think it feels like to be the liar? What do you think it feels like to be lied to? Is it okay to lie if you can get away with it? You can start a whole new dialogue with your kids, and kids are really smart and thoughtful about this.
Right.
They have some conscience. They don't come from no point of view whatsoever.
Right.
So you can engage them in that. And I don't think you have to withhold love, but,
right,
but you can engage them in that discussion and get a feel for where they stand on that, and, you know, what's okay and what the limits are in their own behavior.
Yep. Dr. John Duffy is here. If you have any questions or comments, we're at 312-981-7200. We'll pick this up in just a little bit. It's Harry and me on WGN. Dr. John Duffy is here. He's the author of The Available Parent. John, school doesn't start for about another month or so.
True.
But we need to pave the way and get things ready for the kids who are going back to school. What are you recommending?
Yeah, so, right. So typically this feels like the wrong time to talk about this. Kids hate talking about going back to school right now, right?
They
feel like, oh man, I have a whole month left of summer. And yet, as parents, we can start to set the scene a little bit for, you know, like setting some structure and some boundaries like the school year usually contains.
Mm-hmm.
And too often, people wait until that first or second week of the school year, and I get the call of, you know, we have chaos in the morning, and we can't get our kids to do their homework because they're still very much in summer mode. The structure of the day is not familiar to them yet. So I think if you ease into that, it works really, really well. I usually tell people start with bedtime. So most of us have let bedtimes go by now by, you know, an hour and a half, you know, like beyond what's normal in the school year.
Yeah.
So if you scale it back 15 minutes a week, your kids hardly notice it.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time you get to school, you're pretty close to, you might not be right on the money, but you're way closer than you would be otherwise.
Yeah, right.
So I always tell parents right at the beginning of August or pretty close to now, start rolling it back a little bit.
We've talked about this before, Dr. John, but my son is engrossed by anything with the screen on it.
Yes.
And if we say it's bedtime, he won't complain. He'll go upstairs, and then he'll be on his phone or for like 3 hours. And I'll hear him giggling. So even though his lights are all off, I'll be like, Reg, we know you're on the phone. We know you're online. you can't do it. So how do I step in, or is everybody doing that? I shouldn't worry.
Most kids are doing this. Here's something I have found works. If everyone in the family is willing to leave the phones charging in the kitchens. In other words, if at bedtime phones do not make it to bedrooms, which seems far-fetched, but every once in a while, Harry, I'm able to get a family to do it. Every once in a great while. And the kids sleep better. They're not, there's so much energy coming off the screen when that thing's on. So if your kid has a friend he's talking to, or he's playing a video game, the idea of turning that thing off makes you feel like you're missing something. There's this juice and this energy going.
Right.
And the likelihood of falling asleep nice and easy is nil. If he wakes up at 2 a.m, he might be inclined, well, my phone's on, I'm just going to text a friend, see what's going on. And kids do this all the time. This is really normal, but it's not really healthy. And good sleep starts to fall away, and then the next day is affected to some extent. If you can get your kid to keep the phone somewhere else, at least at night, that makes a huge difference. It's difficult to get started a couple weeks in, and they're usually sold on it.
It's too early to tell because we've only had cell phones really for, 15, 20, 25 years, right? But what do you think the long-term reaction will be to the fact that now the phone has become part of our brain?
Yep.
In the long run, there's going to be some changes, aren't there?
For sure. One interesting thing I'm seeing is for kids who take a break from their phone, and I'm talking about like 16-year-olds, 17, 18, if they take a break for a few days, and every once in a while a kid's inclined to do this because they feel overwhelmed and they have this instinct like, I can't take it, it's making me anxious.
Yes.
A lot of these kids will go and buy a burner or a flip phone or something like that and just carry that around for a while. So one thing I think we're going to start seeing is people taking a vacation from social media at the very least.
So it's like methadone.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Kinda,
exactly like methadone, right? We're gonna go light on the exposure to the phone, the texting, the social media, and all of that. But it's better than being kind of full on all the time.
Yeah.
And I think the more often we can get our kids to step off the grid, the more they'll recognize, oh, this is what life feels like.
Right.
Because kids right now are never off the grid. They never have that feeling of, like, I'm off.
And also, the other thing is, Big Brother is watching. This face app that everybody's falling in love with.
Yeah.
You can see what you'll look like years. Or you can go back and see like what you looked like 30 years ago, or you could just look at an old picture.
Right.
So it turns out it's a Russian-made app.
Yes.
And people are gathering our information. I don't think like kids think about that enough.
No. If you think about being a kid and this is introduced to you, right? You get your phone. My parents gave me the phone. And you start downloading apps off the store. You don't think about like what's the origin of this. Mostly you think this is probably temporary, and the likelihood of any of this getting me in any trouble is not non-existent. And kids usually have to have an experience that's negative, and most kids do that in order to recognize, ooh, this can all burn me. Not necessarily on that scale either. You know what I mean? Like that idea like an international event, But
do you think that's just because as a nature we want to be more trusting and you don't really realize the consequence sometimes?
Yeah, and I think there's a little naivete too. I mean, you have this thing and it's a really exciting tool. If we were 15 and somebody handed us iPhones, I think we'd be like blown away and super excited.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's more that than anything else. I don't know if kids are really thinking about any big picture whatsoever other than this is cool and fun and a great way to keep in touch with my friends and play some games.
Right. Remember the cavemen looking at the monolith in 2001 and just they didn't know if it was good or bad. That's how we are with our phones.
Absolutely.
We don't know what they are. All right. Dr. John Duffy's his name. When's the next time people can hear you here on WGN?
I should be here in 2 weeks, hopefully.
Here on our show.
Here on your show, yeah.
But with podcasts and things, still up and running.
So you should find my podcast with my wife, Julie, better. On iTunes or here, and my podcast with Heidi Stevens called On Purpose.
Perfect. Thanks, John. Appreciate
Thank you
being here. A quick break, some news, and then more show. It's Bill Leff and Harry Tynowitz in for Wendy on WGN. Jen, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff. It's Harry Tynowitz. Harry is filling in for Wendy. Wendy will return on Friday. A great article on the front page of the Chicago Tribune on Monday talking about the impact of homicides and gun violence on young children in Chicago. Numbers that are frightening and staggering. Here to talk about that article and about the problem in general is Jeffrey Nagel. Jeffrey's the president and CEO of the Erickson Institute. Jeffrey, thank you for being here.
Thanks
really
for having
appreciate
me.
It.
My pleasure.
All right. I was lucky enough, Harry, in a similar situation, to grow up in neighborhoods where homicides and gun violence weren't a major factor. I went to bed every night very peacefully knowing that things were going to be status quo in the morning. But so many kids in the city of Chicago and the areas around it don't have that luxury. How bad are things getting right now?
Right. It's really a staggering number when we think about the exposure to violence that our young children have. So, of course, you can define violence in lots of different ways. For this report, we just wanted to look at exposure to homicides, right? It's kind of the end of the scale of violence. And obviously, the city has struggled a lot with homicides. But you always hear about the victim and the perpetrator. But it's obviously much bigger than that. It involves families. It involves communities. And children, obviously, are part of those communities. So we wanted to document just how much exposure to homicides and that type of violence young children, meaning children under five, how much exposure they have to this, whether they see it or they're just living in those communities. So if you think about Chicago as the 77 neighborhoods or communities that they are, we then mapped out where the homicides took place and basically wanted to document how many children live in a neighborhood that had above the median number of murders. Mm-hmm. And we looked at that the last 3 years. So just looking at 2018, of the 176,000 children in the city who are under five, almost 60%, 105,000, live in a community that had more than three homicides. So that's from three
that number's unacceptable.
Up to 56.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, like, you grew up in a community where you never thought about that.
Yeah.
Right? And I was fortunate to grow up in a community like that as well. If there was a homicide in my community, we would have talked about it for 10 years.
Right.
And yet for some of these kids, they're growing up in a neighborhood where there's a homicide every 2 to 3 weeks.
Where, forgive me for using the word normal, but to them it almost becomes normal.
Well, I would submit it's never normal.
It should never be normal.
You're going to have a response to that.
Yeah.
And if we want our children to reach their full potential, which I think every parent wants for their kid, and I think you ask anybody, of course we want that for our children, our community's children, the children of Chicago. And they are the future of Chicago. And if we want those kids to reach their full potential, we're making it really difficult if they have to absorb that kind of community stress and community violence and learn to manage and cope with that, whether that's a conscious thing, which, of course, if you're under five, it's not, or it's kind of in the air and it limits the kind of activities you do and how late you play outside or if you play outside at all or how emotionally present your family is or your parents are because they're dealing with the aftermath of some horrific, violent act.
Yep.
So just because kids won't remember it and aren't maybe aware of it doesn't mean it's not having a huge impact in how they develop.
Jeffrey, you know, it's horrible when you watch the news and you see one teenager in a gang, you know, shot another teenager in a gang, or a drug dealer gets shot by one of his customers. But what's just horribly upsetting is when someone is in their house and they get hit with like a drive-by bullet, a bullet that was meant for somebody else. I mean, so I think it's awesome that, you know, among the things you want to do is like teach these people. How do you keep your kids safe when having them at home, they could still have a random bullet come flying through their window?
Right. Can you imagine living in a home where you actually have to think about that and maybe talk about that and not be by the front windows or the front room because you think about that? I mean, I can't even fathom. But obviously, we read about those situations in the paper, and it's beyond terrible. And again, even if the child isn't the victim of such a horrible random act, they're part of families who are dealing with that. And so there is an impact on everyone in that family, and that, of course, impacts a young child, again, whether they're aware of it or not. It's definitely going to impact their experience, and that's what we're really focused on at Erickson, is what is the early childhood experience.
How does Chicago's situation differ, or is it more similar to that of other cities? We keep hearing data about Chicago and the gang violence and the gun violence, and it's never good. So how do we stack up with other cities?
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, we have a big problem with these homicides. But even if we
reduce the homicides by 50%. So last year there were 580. So let's say we cut that to 290. That still would be more than one a week happening in the city. And, you know, that would be like five a week happening in the city. And that would be horrible. So we have a long way to go. And many other cities, even if their homicide rates are far lower, are still struggling. So, you know, like, what number of homicides would be acceptable, right? Zero. So I lived in New Orleans for many years before I moved here. We had a horrible situation with that as well, and many urban centers do. So this is not unique. And the other struggle that is not unique is the need to focus on young children and help them deal with these terrible events and help the families deal with these terrible events, because the child grows up in the context of their relationship. So it's the whole family we're talking about. Or what are the supports and services that we as a community provide to the families,
right,
to the parent-child relationships or the caretaker-child relationships, and even the caretakers, whether they're at child care centers or in the schools in the early grades? All of these people are involved. And as adults, we deal with trauma and violence differently than young children. As an adult, we may want to protect ourselves by not talking about it, not thinking about it, not wanting to communicate about it. Whereas a little kid absolutely wants to talk about it. And if you put a piece of paper in front of them with a crayon, they're going to draw somebody getting hurt,
right,
or some kind of violent act. And yet the adult is like trying to shut that down because we deal with it differently. And so we as the adults need to understand that that's the dynamic, and yet we need to allow our children to express themselves and let it out, and then learn how to reassure them, to help them feel safe in a world that is a little threatening. And what are we going to do about that? And how does that impact all of us and all the people that love you and that you love?
So I know it's very early on in her new role, but Emmanuel wanted to put more cops there and feel better because we have more cops there. I've heard Mayor Lightfoot also wants to add a great deal of policemen. Do you believe that the new mayor is going to help you in your quest to protect and educate the young?
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, a new administration is always a great opportunity. You reset a little bit, and certainly they've been doing a great job of collecting tons of information and input and great ideas from people in the communities to find out what do communities need to thrive. And so we're certainly in conversations and trying to shift the focus. It's not just law enforcement, as you're bringing up, which is part of the equation, but it's also prevention and intervention before other problems happen. So if you leave a 3, 4, 5-year-old child to deal with year in and year out multiple homicides in their community, what do we really expect is going to happen with that child's behavior when they're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old? And yet we as the adults say, well, he's not showing us any problems, so we're good. Then at 11 or 12, they're bigger, they're stronger, you know, boys or girls, I'm not just blaming boys, but now they're a little bit more capable of scaring us, becoming violent, causing more problems, and so then we start reacting. So we should have intervened very early on, because you can kind of, it's not an accident that a child's having behavior problems, conduct disorder, can't get along with others, can't pay attention in school, if they're dealing with violence and trauma, repeated violence,
right,
and repeated trauma in their communities. I mean, how would you fare in that situation?
When you say intervene earlier, specifically how, to what degree do you come in and intervene exactly?
Well, right. So there's a continuum. Not everyone would need the same thing. But
right,
clearly, the closer you are to the violence, whether it was someone that unfortunately was killed in your family, whether the violence happened in your home, in front of your home, to someone visiting your home, an aunt, uncle, you know, depending. How you help the family grieve and deal with that. Again, the adults might have a very different response to the grieving process than what an infant or toddler would have. And helping the adults understand and release from the perspective of the child, how is the child experiencing this? What are the child's needs? What do they need to know and hear and feel in order to move on from this and feel safe? And we're not super good at that, right? Parenting is hard enough,
sure,
let alone throw in such a horrible situation and then ask people to deal with it in the midst of dealing with, you know, a grieving situation. So it's really difficult, and parents and families and communities need support, and that would be at the highest level, meaning the broadest, and then all the way down to early child mental health services for a child who's really demonstrating difficulty adjusting and accepting and fear, their anxiety, their aggression, their withdrawal, sadness, what all of those things.
There's so much going on.
There's so much going on, absolutely.
Jeffrey Nagel's here, the president and the CEO of the Erickson Institute. We're talking about the impact of homicides and gun violence on young children in Chicago. If you'd like to jump in with a question or a comment, 312-981-7200, we'll get that done. It's Bill and Harry in for Wendy on WGN. Jeffrey Nagel's our guest. He's the president and CEO of the Erickson Institute. We're talking about the impact of homicides and gun violence on young children here in Chicago. Do me a favor, Jeffrey, off the air during the commercial break, we were talking about these numbers and these findings. And as you said, it is overwhelming. Talk about the mere impact of that, the fact that it is so overwhelming, because the difference can be made. We have to understand that it's overwhelming and somehow get around that.
Right. So, you know, on the one hand, when we talk about 105,000 children in the city under five growing up in a community that had more than three homicides, right?
Yeah.
That's terrible to think about and overwhelms us. And it's such bad news. We don't want to kind of go there and think about that. And so in the psychology of it, you worry that, like, okay, it sounds too big and everyone's going to say, well, I can't impact that, so I'm not going to engage. And the reality is what we need people to do is to come together and just say, we agree. We need to address these issues. You know, all of us are not mental health experts, but we understand that we can't pretend that these types of things don't impact our children.
Right.
And that even though they're not going to be cognitive memories because they're less than five, they are going to leave biological memories. They will impact us for the rest of our lives in ways that we're not even aware of. And we know that adverse childhood experiences, early life stressful events, can have long-term health consequences. It brings about the illnesses and disease of old age at younger ages. So whether it's heart disease, cancers, respiratory disease, diabetes, you know, like all the illnesses that are the common causes of morbidity and mortality in our society, the more stressful your childhood experiences, the earlier those things happen in life, right? So we know that from the science. So there's the health impact, and then there's the educational success of our children. And we know the more stress you're dealing with in your life, the harder it is to pay attention, focus, get along with others, follow the rules, learn the things that we need our children to learn. So when you're talking about something that is a threat to educational success and long-term health success, well, that's kind of the core of what we all need, right?
Sure.
We all need to be healthy, and we all need to be educated. And
right.
It's what, in the public sector and government, that's where we spend the majority of our resources.
Yeah.
And yet, the root of it all is in the early childhood period. And so here, we're trying to point out that we have a real challenge, that over half of our children are growing up with severe adversity, and we can't pretend that it's not happening, and so that we have to engage and mobilize to start providing a constellation of services, from modest interventions for children and families and parental interventions, all the way to more tertiary intervention, which would be early childhood mental health services, which isn't putting a baby on a couch. It's about working with the caretakers, the parents,
right,
and the child, and really strengthening the relationship, because the relationship is what will buffer the stress for the child, or the absence of the relationship will leave the child alone to deal with that stress. The child experiences the world through relationships, and we all have to understand that, so we have to do everything we can to support the relationships.
You know, I have friends that do neighborhood watch where they live, and somebody on our, you know, cul-de-sac, you know, organized a neighborhood watch. But it's a whole lot different when you have a neighborhood watch going on in South Shore or Englewood. Are people physically, like, out there, out of their homes, you know, trying to let people know, hey, we got our eyes out for you? Or are they kind of, like, in-home, you know, trying to protect themselves and their families?
Well, you know, you and your listeners would know the answer to that as much as I would. I would think it's kind of all of the above. Some may be, you know, shuddering and hiding inside, and other people may be really trying to mobilize and get their community organized to kind of take back their communities, and then everything in between. And that is certainly a big piece of the puzzle. I think ultimately this is solved from the community up, not from, you know, government or the top down. But it's in partnership. And so it's everything from appropriate law enforcement and resources all the way to the supports and services so that we can give children and families what they need to succeed. And when there is adversity, they may need a little more, and we have to be prepared to do more in those situations, because the long-term return on that investment has been well documented by noted economists, and we all win in those scenarios.
I hate to bring this part of it up, but it is an element to this. There's a price tag on this. There's costs to everything that you've mentioned. If you want to do counseling for the people, the kids that are living there, someone has to pay for it. Where does that money come from?
Yeah, there's costs for intervening, and there's much greater costs for not intervening.
Oh, sure.
And the cost of these criminal activities and all that we have to absorb as a city to fight the crime, to overcome the perceptions of our city and what that means for how our city thrives and businesses and all of those things. So there's a cost either way.
Yeah.
One may be a little bit under the table, and one is over the table, and we got to like say, well, are we going to put up the physical dollar to intervene because we know it pays off? So, you know, noted economists, Nobel Prize winning economists right here, you know, in Chicago at the University of Chicago have documented that when we make investments in young children, we get a huge return. This is Jim Heckman at the University of Chicago. He says that the greatest use of public resources are resources invested in our young children. And, you know, we may hear a lot of rhetoric about government functioning in the most efficient way, and yet the most efficient use of public dollars and tax breaks and tax incentives, all these things, are dollars invested in our young children. Mm-hmm. Because you get a return on those educational outcomes and long-term health. And those are the most expensive things for government. When you fail a child in the educational system, or you have health consequences, those are super expensive too. So there's costs everywhere you look, but one is, are we going to be focused on prevention and return on investment, or are we going to be focused on just solving the problem after it becomes really clear, and now we have a big lifelong chronic situation that we have to overcome?
Are you optimistic about this? I'm hoping your answer is yes, but I don't know.
Are you?
How are you optimistic? Because you've thrown out some very frightening numbers. I'm thrilled to hear you're optimistic, but tell me why you are.
I'm optimistic because we clearly know, the larger we, clearly know that we have to do more to invest in young children and families, right? So in the country, in the city, we hear more and more about this topic. We hear it on the campaign trail now in the presidential politics. We hear a lot about pre-K. We hear somewhat more about child care, paid parental leave, and it's trickling in. What we need to do is accelerate that. Because look, from 0 to 3, which is the foundation of your educational success and lifelong health, 0 to 3 is 1,100 days.
Yeah.
So every 1,100 days, we've missed like another generation of kids.
Yeah.
So the longer we wait to mobilize and start making those investments, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. So I'm optimistic that we know. I'm optimistic that the larger we know, because more and more people are coming on board saying, yeah, these are appropriate public investments. How fast we make those moves is really the challenge. And I think these conversations, you know, on radio with your listeners and others in newspapers, on TV, the more we talk about this and the more we get our leaders to embrace this and say, yes, these are smart investments, the more we'll see change and the more we will all benefit. And I think that is happening.
Good. Good, so good. Jeffrey Nagel's his name. He's the president and CEO of the Erickson Institute. Go to Erickson, I-N-S-T, E-R-I-K-S-O-N-I-N-S-T. More information is there. That's on Twitter, correct? I want to make sure I'm getting that right.
Right, or Erickson. Of course, Erickson.edu.
Yeah, on the web. Thank you, Jeffrey. Really appreciate that.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, the stories that matter with Jen DeSalva from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Harry and I will be on the stream for the bonus hour. Please join us there for the bonus hour.